and WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News,
app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. An Oregon man is facing a federal interstate kidnapping charge. FBI agent in charge, Stephanie Shark, says 29-year-old Negasi Zuberi posed as a police officer, kidnapped a woman, drove her hundreds of miles to his home, then locked her in a cinder block cell until she escaped.
Through her perseverance, she broke free and waved down a passing motorist asking for their help to call 911.
Shark says they're now looking to see if the suspect had other victims. Mexico's Foreign Affairs Secretary says a body was found stuck in the razor wire wrap buoys that Texas placed in the Rio Grande. They say the cause of death and nationality are unknown. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen saying she strongly disagrees with the Fitch decision to downgrade the U.S. credit rating.
Its flawed assessment is based on outdated data and fails to reflect improvements across a range of indicators, including those related to governance.
This is ABC News. ABC News confirming that CVS, Walgreens, and Rite Aid are preparing to offer the RSV vaccine for older adults this fall. RSV is a respiratory virus that's mild for most except the youngest and oldest. An arrest in a deadly hit-and-run in Florida is made with the help of Google.
File this one under. You never know what a Google review will do. Someone posted a one-star review on the page of a tree trimming service in the Tampa Bay area looking for the driver of one of the company's trucks seen on video involved in a deadly hit-and-run accident that injured one motorcyclist and killed another. The review read, "The thing is, he fled the scene, and all I got was his company name on his white truck. Please, if anyone's seen his truck with a hit on the passenger side, that's the bike that he hit and ran like a coward." Turns out investigators read that review and were able to connect the dots. 29-year-old Chad Stahl, a worker for the tree trimming service, arrested and charged. Derek Dennis, ABC News.
Rain helping firefighters battle a massive blaze in the California desert and Nevada. Andy Field, ABC News.
Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Here's what you need to know in Amory. A weekend crash between three vehicles, with one of them hitting a garage, left four people hurt over the weekend. The Barron County Sheriff's Office said the crash happened on Highway 48 between Rice Lake and Cumberland Saturday night. An SUV rear-ended a pickup truck that was waiting to turn left, which pushed it head-on into an oncoming pickup truck. The second truck then went into the ditch and hit a garage. The four people hurt in the crash were taken to hospitals. Three other people were treated on scene and released. Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan asked for the release of security footage at the U.S. Capitol from last week when fellow Wisconsin Congressman Derek Van Orden yelled at Senate pages. Congressional leaders condemned Van Orden's act last week. The footage is being reviewed by U.S. Capitol Security, according to a release from Representative Brian Stile. Van Orden said he won't publicly apologize. And according to the National Weather Service in the Twin Cities, the conditions for the next couple of days will be hot and humid. However, there are rain chances in the forecast for over the weekend. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
All right, folks, let's get started. Parents, thanks for coming. As many of you know, I'm Coach Mather. Tonight I want to talk about the season, of which I only have one expectation, that everybody gets stronger. When I say get stronger, I'm not referring solely to physical strength. Sure, we'll be in the weight room, we'll be running stairs, but we're also going to focus on developing mental toughness and grit, because those are the characteristics that allow us to achieve greatness both on and off the court. So, how do we develop those things? By getting comfortable with a challenge, by cultivating the confidence necessary to overcome adversity in all forms. That's why I coach. That's my purpose. Every member of this team can lean on me, and I'll teach them how they can lean on themselves and each other.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
She's the newest of seven elected Wisconsin Supreme Court justices. Janet Protasiewicz begins her 10-year term in August when she is sworn in. It's a longtime tradition which includes use of the court's seal created in 1848. But did you know it features the scales of justice, but not carried by a blindfolded Greek goddess? Instead, a hand holds the scales, representing justice is in human hands. It also means everything is official once the seal is stamped on any court documents. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr. Flowers, vegetables, and crab apples, some of the first Marathon County Fair attractions, and showed us proof those crops could grow there. Started in 1868 by the Agricultural Society, the Wisconsin Valley Fair in Wausau began as a place to buy and sell those types of goods. Today, it's considered one of the best in the state, featuring displays, demos, and big-name entertainment included with the price of your ticket. The Wisconsin Valley Fair runs August 1st to the 6th in Wausau. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month for news, weather, and emergency information. A new bill in Congress would make sure AM radio remains in cars. Because when cell and internet services are down, this free service could be your only lifeline. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Wisconsin's home for daily conversations about the state's latest headlines and stories. Weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
At greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So hot labor summer in full swing. And you know, as we've been talking about the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors, the strike that they're on, the Teamsters with UPS and the contract that they've got, you're seeing labor actions all across the country. And in New York, the Transport Workers Union of America, TWU, they took out a one-page ad in three different newspapers to tell the MTA CEO that, hey, we're serious. We want a fast-track strike action. We're serious about getting better wages, hours, conditions for our members. And this is good stuff. This is the kind of stuff that has to keep happening if we're going to rebuild and revitalize the middle class of this country. That's why I've asked John Samuelson to come talk with us. John's the international president of the Transport Workers Union, TWU.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on.
So walk me through what's going on here. What's with the newspaper ads?
Well, without a contract, without a workforce at Metro North, two local unions of comprised of car inspectors, essentially train mechanics and car cleaners, about 500 workers. We've been out of contract for about 4 years. So enough's enough. We're in the NMB process right now. We're in mediation and we're fighting back. So this is one element of the workforce we have at the MTA in New York. We have the flagship local of TW Local 100, which is the bus and subway workers, where we've just settled our second contract. So we've lapped essentially our locals at Metro North, and we're disgusted by that. And we're going to fight really New York City subway style on the railroad tracks north of the city, in the suburbs north of New York City. And we're going to run a strategic campaign. What you saw today was the first elements, the first salvo of that strategic campaign. We're going to fight politically and every other way we can. We're going to comply with the NMB and the Railway Labor Act process. And in the interim, we're going to run a strategic campaign. We're going to win, and we're going to get a contract.
4 years you've been without a contract? So during the entire pandemic, you guys have been out of contract?
Essentially during the entire pandemic, these workers have come to work. They've done everything they're supposed to do. And yet these bosses at the MTA have lied to them, scammed them, tried to get them repeatedly to take an inferior contract, a contract that is definitely economically less valuable than what the existing economic pattern is. That's part of what this is about. So as many places in the public sector, we're dealing with pattern bargaining. And yet the bosses at the MTA and this labor relations oriented machine that we've run into so many times here has seen fit to really to sort of just sort of absolutely totally disrespect their workers at Metro North and on the Long Island Railroad for that matter, where we don't have members, but they're in the same boat as us, and come through with an economic pattern that is less than what the prevailing pattern is, and we're fighting back. But there's one other element of this that is incredibly serious. In fact, it's probably more serious, which is they want language from us that says that the contract becomes amendable immediately upon signing the contract, immediately upon ratification of the contract. They want the ability to unilaterally change the terms of the contract if the finances of the employer go south in the opinion of the employer. So it's absolutely ludicrous, ridiculous language. It's language that we will never acquiesce to. And we'll go on strike and we'll shut the railroad down before we settle for any of those terms.
No, I got to stop you here. I mean, they want you to sign a contract that as soon as you sign it, they can change it. I wish I could get a mortgage company that would allow me to have that kind of an agreement. Yeah, I'm willing to pay you this amount today. We'll sign this contract, but tomorrow I'm going to amend it because I may not want to work overtime, so I'll only pay you half.
Yeah, it sounds like hyperbole on my part. It sounds like a gross exaggeration. The federal mediator thought that as well, and that's exactly what the language says. It's no exaggeration, and. You know, unfortunately, they actually compelled a couple of unions to sign that language already. So they're trying to get a beachhead. Fortunately, they ran into us, and we're going to stop them.
Now, would you agree that maybe they're still thinking pre-pandemic kind of bargaining? Because I've talked to a lot of union leaders who think, you know, employers still haven't gotten the message, the memo on the new world in which we now live, where workers aren't going to put up with the same, hey, I'm just happy to have a job, that they lived through a period where employers in the community was telling them that they're essential and they're heroes and you know, lots of nice flowery language, no raises, no better benefits, no better working conditions, but some nice words. And now those workers are going, hey, we want to live those truths. We want to be treated with dignity. Are you seeing that kind of dynamic?
I think certainly with that language is an element of that. There is an element of that. There's an element of second-class citizenship here involved here as well. The language actually does reference COVID. The couple of unions that they compelled to sign signed it during COVID, or at least in the end stages of COVID. But so there's a little bit of that. But also in the interim, the labor movement itself and our partners in the trade union movement delivered a huge financial windfalls from them out of Washington, D.C. And furthermore, we delivered financial windfalls for them out of Albany. And the union movement itself has stabilized the MTA budget both in New York State as well as federally for this MTA operation. So in order to demand language that makes the contract amendable it's just kicking dirt in the face of the workers themselves that delivers stability to the budget of the employer. So it's absolutely ludicrous. We're never going to sign it. And what it's doing is organizing their own workforce to conduct strike action against them.
So what can people do to help? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, do phone calls to the MTA, you know, calls to legislators. What's the action? What's the request?
Well, the request by certainly in the ad today was to have phone calls to the chairman of the MTA, a guy named Jan Oliba, comes out of the real estate industry. So those calls are happening. We know for a fact that phones are ringing off the hook today. The rioters are stunned. They're startled. There hasn't been strike action at Metro North in quite some time, maybe 40 years or more. So these are muscles that neither the workers nor the rioters have seen flexed in quite some time. And we're flexing them now. So it's our intention to run this campaign. We don't want to see a strike, but you know the deal. We're gonna continue to build. We're gonna continue to organize internally. We're gonna continue to organize the riders, and hopefully we don't get to a strike. But if we do get to a strike, we're damn sure gonna be prepared for that strike, and we're gonna win that strike.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's as I always say, it's the last arrow in the quiver, but it's got to be there. Even if you don't use it, it's got to be there. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with John Samuelson. John is the international president of the Transport Workers Union. You can check out their website, twu.org. to find out what they're doing and maybe get a look at the ads that they put out. Now, I also wanted to ask you because, you know, we've been seeing a lot of our other union friends in the transportation industry saying that their members have been under not just economic stress like some of your members are going through right now, but also the threats of violence. We've seen, according to my friends at ATU, the Amalgamated Transit Union, they're saying that the number of assaults on bus drivers and transit people are through the roof. Are you seeing the same thing with your members?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the ATU is a sister union of ours. John Costa, the international president, is a good friend of mine. In fact, I have a meeting with him coming up. Might even be next week. I'd have to look at my calendar. It's something that we talk about frequently, assault. It's something that we work on frequently across the country. And I was the president of TW Lock 100 in New York City for quite a many years. And I've developed friendships with the local presidents in New York that have lasted even with me going to the international. And in New York alone, there are weeks where there's five assaults against bus operators, both ATU and TW. We work together to face this down. And I think that there has to be solutions. And I do believe that we are going to turn the corner on this collectively, particularly with the TW and the ATU. We're going to win. We're going to achieve results. And one of those results has the potential to end the assaults as we know them. And that is the cockpitting of the bus operators in the front of the bus. So that total complete segregation of the bus operator, it has to happen. And right now, buses aren't manufactured in that way. And I think with the collective pressure that we are putting on the manufacturers and on the employers themselves, the bus operators, the bus agencies, we'll win. And I think this will be, I think with this collective approach that we're undertaking, it'll be a thing of the past. And this nightmare will go away. And it's not only the bus operators, actually, the subway side personnel, rail side personnel face the same exact thing. And we're trying to figure out how to insulate our train crews in similar ways.
And how do we pass laws to make sure that when people do engage in that kind of behavior, that they're dealt with appropriately and that there are severe, stiff penalties for this? I mean, at some point, I don't know when we've lost our minds, and I don't know when it became okay to attack a bus driver who's just trying to do their job. But we're in this weird kind of moment, John, and it's it's frustrating, it's angering, but there's got to be a way out of this.
Well, I'll tell you, we've run into problems in city after city. And just to tell it like it is, we've run into problems with Democratic district attorneys that don't want to lock people up that assault blue-collar workers. And it's freaking outrageous. And it's part of the problems that blue-collar Americans have with the Democratic Party right now. You punch a freaking bus operator in the face, drag the bus operator off the bus. You could be like a 240-pound middle linebacker type dude. You drag a female bus operator off the bus and pummel them, and a Democratic district attorney doesn't want to press charges. And we've endeavored to pass state and local laws raising the penalties against those who assault transit workers, and we still run into the problem of district attorneys that don't want to press charges. And this is a major problem that the TW faces, the ATU faces, and it's something's got to give. And I do believe that there is a blue-collar, blue-collar blowback. And anybody who doesn't recognize that is just not seeing the truth for the truth.
No, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I'm someone who says you have to protect workers. I don't care what political stripe you are. You protect people when they go to work. You negotiate contracts, you enforce contracts based on wages, hours, conditions, and standing up for people in the workplace is just a no-brainer for me. And it's sad to hear that there are people out there who won't take these folks off the street. I mean, you've got to start making examples of some people.
It's absolutely insane. If you assault a bus operator in Manhattan, in New York County, try getting the district attorney in Manhattan to prosecute a violent freaking criminal that assaults one of our bus operators. It's very difficult, and it's a very bad spot to be in.
So what can we do? I mean, ultimately, you know what? Because I think we pass laws, but if you're not going to enforce them, what's the point of passing laws?
Right. So we work it, and we have groups of workers constantly meeting in New York and beyond with district attorneys, constantly arguing our case, constantly explaining that the will of working people is not to be subjected to violent assault, and that violent assault is of working people, transit workers and beyond transit workers. they gotta get segregated away from normal society. If you punch somebody in the face in the course of their work, you don't deserve to be walking among us. That's just the way it is.
That is just the way it is. And it's a good thing they got folks like you fighting for their rights. John, I appreciate you taking some time for us. I wish you the best on the Metro North deal. I hope you'll come back and give us some updates as this continues. Again, I hate to see people go on strike, but when you have to, one day longer, brother. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. John Samuelson, president of the Transport Workers Union, TWU.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stay around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, it's interesting John brings up the assaults and not being prosecuted. And this has been a knock against, honestly, a knock against Democratic district attorneys or attorney generals or all this stuff. The idea that they don't want to be seen as locking people up. Look, I don't want to lock people up either, unless you've done something wrong. You know, at the end of the day, if you're beating up a bus driver who's just doing their job for no reason, if you're beating up people on the bus, that's not good for society. You need to remove those folks. You need to move them away. You know, it's important that people learn how to, and I know the pandemic kind of had a lot to do with this. We don't know how to be around others yet again, and there's an adjustment period. But there is no reason to hit a bus driver. I used to ride the bus all the time. Have I had some really bad bus drivers? Yeah, there have been some you know, obnoxious people. You're on the bus to get from point A to point B. That's what you do. Not to beat up the bus driver. And this is one of those weird things, because the idea of quarantining off the driver, cockpitting the driver, as John Samuelson said, is not new. This is something that I've talked about in the past, probably it's got to be at least 10 years that we've been saying, well, it makes no sense. You know, because I remember I used to work at night in downtown Cleveland, and I would have to take the bus, you know, from, you know, one place to the Rapid under the terminal and then out to, you know, the suburbs on the Rapid. And I remember, you know, the person who's operating either the Rapid or the bus is on that thing alone in the middle of the night in not some great areas. And you go, you know, how do you protect that person from, you know, now the money is completely secure because you drop the money in the little thing. It goes down into a box. Good luck figuring out how to get that. So, you know, robbing the bus doesn't happen. Just beating up the bus driver and taking what they've got. I guess that happens. So for me, there's no reason not to be locking people up who do these kind of things, especially against working people. I mean, why? Why would you? Why would you? It makes no sense. But I do want to hear your thoughts. And look, John's not wrong. There are some district attorneys who don't want to get on the wrong side of the messaging. Look, I'm someone who says we lock far too many people up for a lot of stupid things. A lot of low-level drug crimes. You go, really? Possession? Seriously? You know, why are we locking people up? But beating up bus drivers? Yeah, you should go away for a while. Something. I want to hear what you think. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Now, earlier I talked a little bit about our good friends, the Republicans, the ones who, you know, who happen to really hate working people. And as I went through some of it, I didn't get to where I wanted to earlier, which is, you know, the fact that their budget process is about gutting all of the regulatory oversight, about gutting any of the protections that workers have through the federal government. And look, Biden, with his announcement on the heat issue, that's great. Problem is who's going to enforce it? You know, it's great to have, you know, the federal right to those kind of protections, but who do you call? Where do you go to get help? Answer? Yeah, good luck. And Republicans understand that. What they really understand is if you can starve government to the point where, you know, you could drag it in the bathroom and drown it, i.e. Grover Norquist, then that's let Democrats pass all the laws they want. If there's no cop on the beat, what does it matter? And I remember a hearing a couple of weeks ago. The Republicans on the House Education and Workforce Committee were yelling at the acting Labor Secretary, Julie Hsu. Evidently, they claim she's not doing enough to protect our children in the workplace, which is one of those things that's just kind of laughable because it's Republican states who are moving to loosen child labor laws to ensure that we put more children into the workplace. Think of the goofy picture with Sarah Huckabee Sanders with a big cheesy smile with all the kids around here who looked miserable. Think about that for a second. But they're going, you're not doing enough to keep our children, particularly migrant children, from doing these dangerous jobs. And you go, I'm sorry? Republican Jim Banks of Indiana called it the biggest humanitarian crisis in American history. And what's Jim Banks's solution for this? Well, he's going to yell it at the acting labor secretary, not actually pass a policy to ensure on the federal level we make sure that kids aren't in dangerous jobs. No, can't do that. It's about grandstanding. It's about the flowery words. Remember what I said, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And what they're doing is they're loosening restrictions. They're loosening regulations. They're making it easier. And understand, it's not going to be my kids that are going to be the ones who are the ones going to be abused in this system. No, it's not going to be your kids probably. It's going to be those migrant kids. You know, as I said yesterday, I took the photo of Sarah Huckabee Sanders and those kids and used the I think it was called Playground AI or something, or Playground Image, and it's the same one that the Asian woman used to make her photograph look more professional. Which turned her white, blonde hair and blue eyes. So I said, you know, hey, you know, make this child look like a child laborer. And oddly enough, they didn't look anything like the kids in the picture. Because it's not going to be, even AI knows, it's not going to be our kids that are going to be the ones doing this. Now understand that these are the same people who, you know, they care about the children, don't want the children to get hurt at work, but want more of them in the workplace. And oh, by the way, the people who do the child labor enforcement, the Department of Wage and Hour Division that does this, the folks who keep track of child labor violations, Republicans want to gut their budget by almost 30%. So while when the cameras are on, saying, we care about the children, especially those children that are working. Oh, see how much we care. We're talking about how much we care. But in their budget, in the thing that actually does something, Now remember, budget doesn't have a snowball's chance of passing. It's a messaging vehicle. They want to gut the organization that really does keep track of child labor. They want to gut that by 30%. Now think about it, where we are. You got states, you know, like Iowa, like Wisconsin, like other places saying, yeah, we're going to Arkansas loosening the restrictions, putting more kids into dangerous jobs. And they want to fund the organization that oversees it at a, well, almost a third less. So as number of kids go up, the inspectors go down. What do you think is going to happen in that scenario? I don't know. I'm not a genius, but I gotta think the abuses going to go way up because there's no cop on the beat. Republicans hate working people. Just look at what they do. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1939. That was the day that the Hatch Act was enacted. The law was named after Senator Carl Hatch, a Democratic senator from New Mexico. The Hatch Act limits political activities by federal employees. One of the reasons the law was passed was due to allegations of corruption by the Works Progress Administration. The WPA was a key program of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal plan to put people back to work during the Great Depression. But critics of the WPA alleged that the program was being used as a form of political patronage, and that the jobs were exchanged as a way to secure votes for the Democratic Party. Although an investigation found no conclusive proof of the allegations, Congress decided to act to define what was appropriate political engagement for a federal employee. Except for the president and the vice president, all federal employees and employees of the District of Columbia must follow the Hatch Act guidelines. Under the Act, federal employees cannot use the authority of their job to interfere with an election. They cannot be a candidate to a public office in a partisan election. They cannot participate in political activity while at work or while wearing a government uniform or driving a government vehicle. But the Hatch Act does not completely stop federal employees from participating in our political system. If they are off the clock, federal employees can still attend political rallies, contribute money to candidates, campaign for candidates, and help register voters. Ensuring the individual rights of free speech and elections free of corruption can be a difficult balancing act, especially for the thousands who call Uncle Sam their boss. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Senator Tom Cotton, a far-out right-winger, is to good public policy what a boll weevil is to a good cotton crop. Totally destructive. But he is politically candid. Rather than disguising his racial bigotry, for example, Tom flaunts it, as he did last month in an open letter to the retail giant, Target. While the senator is usually a devoted corporate-hugging Republican, he lashed out at Target for business policies that he furiously condemns as racially discriminatory against white people. What popped Tom's cork was the chain's pledge to increase the number of black people it hires by 20%. Holy Dixieland, wailed Cotton. Hiring more of them means fewer jobs for us white people. He insisted that Caucasians had the right to take any and all of Target's jobs. Interestingly, Target's gesture to racial equality was made 3 years ago, with no peep of protest from the now infuriated Cotton. What changed? The GOP's dog-whistling tune, the new politically correct line of anti-black racists, even parroted by today's Republican Supreme Court, is that all efforts to provide racial fairness and balance are, get this, illegal racism against the white majority. So Cotton is just scurrying aboard his party's latest anti-black bandwagon, proclaiming that whites must be protected from racial progress. Not only are Tom and his ilk threatening teachers, librarians, and local governments for promoting equality, but also brand-name corporations that they claim to be woke. That is, not solely focused on profits, but also promoting a little attention to America's need for social justice. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, Tom's clique piously claims to be devout Christians, but guess who was supremely woke? Jesus! Tom Cotton needs to review the Sermon on the Mount, for Jesus declared that those who hunger and thirst for justice are blessed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So recently, the nation celebrated 58 years of Medicare. And you know, I was thinking about this, and you know, my grandmother, when she was at the end of her life, you know, I've said this before, had you threatened to take Medicare away from my grandmother, she would have beat you with her walker, because she understood how important that was. And her generation was really the one that built it. I mean, they were the ones who got it passed in the law. They were the ones who fought year after year to make it better, something that you would want to defend and pass on. And yet here we are in this moment where there are forces doing everything they can do to, well, privatize and profitize. But here to share some thoughts on the big anniversary, 58 years of Medicare, and what we can do to reclaim it. I've asked Carmen Rhodes to come talk with us. She's a senior advisor with the Be Hero Group. BeAHeroFund.com is their website. Carmen, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show, Rick.
So 58 years is kind of a big deal. I mean, and you stop and think about where it started, not so great, to the point to where, you know, when my grandmother was still walking, you know, like I said, you know, she'd have beat you with her walker, and you just talked about taking it away.
That's right. Your grandmother and my grandmother fought really hard to have this rock solid guarantee of health care that many generations of Americans have relied on. And I know I want it to be there for me when I retire and when I need it. I want it to be there for my kids when they need it as well.
Yeah, I'm counting down the years, actually, because the only thing that at this point in my life, I'm 56, the only thing that is keeping me from retiring and wanting to go do something else that I want to do is healthcare costs. You get rid of healthcare costs, I'm gone. And I think there are a lot of Americans who are in the same kind of thing, where, you know, you give them the option to have some health security, they're going to pursue other passions, they're going to pursue other lines of work. And that would be a good thing, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And too many Americans don't have that guarantee of health care.
So I want to start with, you know, what is the Be a Hero Fund? What do you guys do?
That is a great place to start. So we are a national health care advocacy organization that was co-founded by Adi Barkin. Adi is an activist. He was diagnosed with ALS about 6 years ago at the age of 32. And he has really used his experience navigating his ALS disease and navigating the healthcare system to raise up and lift up what's broken about our healthcare system. And so Adi has really been a champion of kind of confronting elected leaders at different key moments, of being a really solid champion for guaranteed healthcare for everybody. And he founded Be a Hero to be a national organization that really lifts up the voices of patients and people who are harmed by the healthcare system, people who are closest to the pain, people who are navigating insurance claims denials or medical debt, or who can't get the home care that they need because they can't afford it, or because there's not enough of an investment in it in this country. So we are a national organization that is really working to unify the grassroots base to ensure that we all have health care.
And it seems like, you know, for me, it's such a simple thing that, you know, in the wealthiest country in the history of civilization, probably at its wealthiest moment, that we have so many people who are health insecure, and you throw everything else in there. You know, people go to bed hungry, people are homeless, and the healthcare problem. There's so many things that we should be working on. And you know, I started today's program off, you know, by talking about an old interview with Carl Sagan and Ted Turner, where he was saying, look, you know, we just don't spend our money right. Other countries choose to prioritize health, education, infrastructure, other things. We just don't seem to do that, do we?
That's right. We could not agree with you more. And that's something that Adi and our other co-executive director, Jamila, say a lot, that this is the wealthiest country in the history of the world. Why is it that people are going without the healthcare that they need? It's because we have prioritized corporate tax giveaways. We've prioritized corporate profit over getting people the things that they actually need. And that's something that we're really working to unify a base of support to fight back against.
What do you say to the person though, Carmen, who says, we just are, you know, yeah, we're a wealthy country, but we can't afford to give everyone health care. We can't afford to give seniors eye and dental and hearing aids. We can't do that. We can't give all this stuff away.
What I would say is that the money's there. We spend more money on healthcare per capita than any other country with socialized medicine, as some would say. And so the money is there. And I know we're in just a moment, we're going to talk a little bit more about Medicare, and the money's there to pay for every single person on Medicare to have vision, hearing, and dental. But it's how we're choosing to spend that money. And that's really where Be a Hero is starting to, we want to sound the alarm about some of the issues that are and some of the problems that that we're facing with Medicare.
I mean, here's the thing. My problem with all of it is you're right. We're spending more money than anyone in the world and getting worse outcomes. We've got more people who are filing bankruptcy because of medical debt. We've got more people who are stressing to the point of, you know, of illness because they can't afford the care that they need. The math just works out. If you had one giant pool, it makes sense to me because what we have done in this country, and I'm sure you'll agree, is we've taken the most expensive people out of the private market and we've taken it out as the taxpayers. You know, in the first 5 years and the last 5 years is when most people use all of the health care they're ever going to use. They are the most expensive and we have taken them out so that the for-profit people, the people who line their pockets, they just take the people who are healthy enough to get jobs and show up to those jobs. It seems to me we could put everyone in one giant pool and it would be much more efficient and it'd be much cheaper.
We could not agree with you more. That is very much where we're coming from. And we, one of the things that I wanted to highlight for your listeners is that very thing that you're talking about, how people who are relatively healthy get cherry picked, that is what's happening in Medicare. So Medicare was created 58 years ago, and about 20 years ago, Medicare Advantage was created. We like to call it Medicare Disadvantage. So this is really private insurance companies that said, we can provide a better product for a cheaper price. And our leaders in Washington bought that and they said, okay, we're going to see what you can do. And so over the last 20 years, private insurance companies have taken over more and more percentage of the Medicare market. And just a couple of months ago, we actually crossed the threshold where more than half of all people on Medicare are now on these Medicare Disadvantage plans. And what we know about these plans, and if you talk to, you know, most of the people that you talk to, if you talk to somebody who's on Medicare and they say, oh, I'm on Medicare Advantage, if they say, and I really like my plan, they usually follow that up with, but I'm a relatively healthy person. So yeah. Most of the people who are choosing to be on Medicare Advantage, Medicare Disadvantage, are people who are relatively healthy, or they're people who are being forced onto these plans, which is something else.
That's a whole other thing. The public sector workers in New York.
Yes.
But you know, here's the thing. Every plan is great until you need it. Every plan is wonderful. I love every plan until you try and file a claim and have to go through all of the nonsense and the hurdles and all of that. And here's the thing. You brought up that they just passed the half threshold. I now expect, and you can help me if you disagree, I now expect a renewed call for Medicare for all, but coming from the Chamber of Commerce and the right. But it won't be traditional Medicare. It won't be that stuff that my grandmother would have beat you over. It'd have been this profitized, privatized kind of stuff where you get a shiny card, you get a nice card, and maybe a gym membership. But if you ever get sick, shame on you.
That's right. And I actually think that the health insurance companies would be perfectly happy to endorse Medicare Advantage for all, because they are making a killing off of Medicare. They are making so much money. And we know that, I mean, Humana, recent one of the biggest providers of Medicare Advantage, they're one of the big seven. They recently announced that they are going to get out of employer-sponsored health insurance, and they're going to pursue this market because it's so lucrative for them. It's guaranteed income. We know there are reports, many reports that are coming out. A recent report from USC came out that shows that these plans are overpaid up to $75 billion every year. And so that's money that is going out from Medicare right into the pockets of these corporate executives. And they are doing it in really sneaky ways. So there's this process of upcoding where these health insurance companies will actually go into everybody's medical records. This happens a lot too when there's an acquisition, you know, of a new provider network. They'll go into everybody's medical records and they will make people look sicker than they actually are. They'll add codes so that they can get more money out of Medicare. So this is an incredibly lucrative business for them. They have figured out how to make a lot of money off of this public benefit program that so many of us want to be able to rely on, but that they are absolutely perverting. And in many ways, I mean, they're destroying the brand. They're getting to call themselves Medicare. They're getting to call themselves Advantage. And as many of our elected leaders who are really like being turned on to what a huge problem this issue is, they're saying it's neither Medicare or an Advantage. It's private insurance. And so it comes with all the problems of private insurance. It comes with the delays and the denials of care. It comes with the, you know, the prior authorization hoops that many folks face when they're trying to get care from their insurance. It comes with the limited provider network. So we've met people along the way as we've embarked on this campaign. We've met people who are fighting cancer who don't have providers in their network that are within like a driving distance to their home. It is really a problem.
But this is what, again, this is what our geniuses in Washington have brought us. And I remember this during the Bush years. Remember, these are the same people who brought us, you know, prescription drugs where we're Americans, damn it. We pay full price. We don't negotiate for drugs. You know, it's quite remarkable when you look at all of the good ideas of the conservative past and the corporatist past and how bad they turned out to be. Because this is, again, I remember, you know, being on the air talking about, you know, how bad this was going to be. And it has proven itself to be every bit as horrible. But here's the thing that they are able to do that Medicare isn't. I flip on the TV and I see ads every day. Hey, you could get this, or hey, look how wonderful this is. We, you know, we have a prescription drug plan, a gym plan. We've got all this great stuff, all these bells and whistles and shiny over here. Look at the shiny stuff. To sell people on the fact that they're getting something better. And what it is, to your point, it's a screw job.
Yes, that is it. That is incredibly deceptive. And that is something that I know lawmakers in Washington want to take on. I mean, the truth is we need to fight back against these private insurance companies that are taking over Medicare. But the other side of this is that we need to fight to improve Medicare. So, and part of our vision and what we're hoping that lots of people will jump on board and start to champion as well, is that if we could claw back these overpayments that we are owed, that the $75 billion that is just going to line these insurance companies' pockets with more profit, we could claw that back. We could provide vision, dental, and hearing to everyone on Medicare. We could lower the Medicare premiums. We could look at doing things like an out-of-pocket cap for Medicare so that people can just choose Medicare, so that they don't have to worry about trying to choose one of these shiny plans that is maybe going to, you know, screw them over in the end. They can just choose Medicare, and it can be the reliable health care that generations of Americans have relied on.
So what do we do on this? Because, you know, here's the weird part. I've talked to people who don't know the difference. Yes. I talk to people who you go, what do you have? Do you have Medicare or do you have a Medicare Advantage? They don't know. They think they've got Medicare. How many of the people who have these Advantage plans or disadvantage plans, as you call them, how many of these people actually think that they've got they just got Medicare?
A lot of people do, and it's really a problem. And that's where they unfortunately, Sorry, I got my kids. My kids are getting ready to go to bed. It's almost bedtime here in California. So people don't know that they're on these deceptive plans until they get really sick.
Right.
And the truth is that for many of us, as we get older, unfortunately, we will face a serious health situation, and we will need that coverage. And unfortunately, more and more people are discovering that these plans are not there for them. And it's something that we're really worried about, that this is still, you know, this plan has been around for 20 years. It's really within the last 5 to 7 years been like a freight train of people joining. And so as this population that's been joining ages, and people do have more health needs and they need the care, we are very worried that it's not going to be there for them. And that this is, and that's why we are trying to sound the alarm to say, this is an urgent need, because the delays and denials are already happening. There's more and more reporting about it. We know that people don't know that they're on these Medicare disadvantage plans. And so we need to sound the alarm with our elected leaders in Washington. We need to sound the alarm with President Biden, because there's a lot that his administration could be doing executively to protect people who are on these plans. And then there's a lot that a Congress that actually wants to get something done, there is so much that they could do to be dealing with delays and denials of care and really investing in Medicare in a way that just makes it better for all of us and makes it so that we can all just choose Medicare.
I think of my grandparents and their generation. Medicare at the beginning wasn't very great. It wasn't very good. Didn't cover much. Wasn't great. They fought to make it better. Every couple of years, they were fighting to make it better. It was an issue that was central to them. And to see us go the other way is really angering. The website, beaherofund.com, lots of information there on how we can begin to reclaim our Medicare. Carmen, I appreciate you taking some time. I know you got kids, you got to get to bed. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. Stop and think about it for a minute. You know, go back to the Bush years. Think about the damage that the Bush administration did to working people. Now, again, I keep coming back to this frame, and I wish it weren't true, but the Republicans hate working people. Look at what they've done. Look at what they've done to Medicare. Oh, no, we're going to privatize it. Private competition's good. Competition's good. What we know is Medicare has X amount of dollars. It's not an infinite sum of money. And we know that these private insurers are overbilling, upcoding, doing all this stuff. In fact, there was just a story not too long ago, I believe I did talk about it, where you have these insurers who are training home health aides. You know, the people who come and help, you know, maybe, you know, do your dishes or, you know, kind of straighten up or help you take a bath or do whatever so that people stay in their home. Because what we know, people staying in their home, happier, cheaper, live longer. We know that. Studies are conclusive. You throw them into a nursing home, it's much, much, much more expensive. It makes people not so happy, and their lives are shorter. That's the reality. So if you keep people in their homes, it's better. So what we do is we send people to help them out. Now you're training those people to go, oh, what? You've got this problem? Oh, well, we should report this back so we can now code you as having all of these ailments. Because what's happened is you no longer get to go to a doctor. I remember the days, come back with me in the Wayback Machine, if you will. I remember being able to go to a doctor visit and the doctor going, hey, how are you doing? What's wrong? And I could go, well, my elbow hurts, my knee hurts, you know, I got the sniffles, you know, my butt itches, you know, whatever. And they would go, okay, let's talk about that. Let's see how we can make you better. oh no, not today. Not today. No, each one of those things, as I was told, if I had all of those ailments, would be four different appointments. I'd have to keep coming back, or they'd code them as four different, you know, treatment things so that they could charge you appropriately. Now, some are going to say, but you know, hey, you know, if you had a car that was broken and it had four turn signals out, you know, you'd have to pay for those. Yeah. Yeah. But you know, here's the deal. You know, a doctor's job is to keep you healthy. And when you have these kind of checkups and you have these kind of things, I don't know, I'm still struggling with the brave new world. And I know very soon it's all going to be done by AI, so it'll probably be moot at that point. But what it's all about is getting more money out of the insurance companies. It's about squeezing more profit out of a system. It's not about people anymore. It's not about care. You know, hospitals aren't run to keep people healthy. They're run to make money. And that's perfectly shown by the fact that most hospitals you see are run by MBAs and not doctors. We need bean counters. You know, the ones who are going to squeeze the quarter till the eagle screams. This is where we are. So when I look at Medicare and the privatization schemes that's going on, and I talked about this back in, you know, was it 06 when Bush did this? The fact that we don't negotiate for prescription drugs, but these Advantage plans can, because they're not Medicare. And they set this up, and again, brilliantly, so that over time, it would eventually take over. They knew what they were doing. This argument of choice, oh no, we need choice for competition. They know what they're doing. It's the same thing with education. It's the same thing with everything we've gone, no, we're going to have choice. You know, we're going to have competition. It's when they put those words in there, it's all about screwing the public sector. It's all about stealing as much profit and as much money from the program as possible. And we're seeing that with Medicare. Are we surprised that when you put a profit motive in there that someone's going to take a huge amount of it? No, it's not surprising at all. So the question then comes back to, how long before we have Medicare disadvantage for all? Because remember, you know, Republicans were against, you know, Medicare for all. They're completely against it. Socialism. And I have said in the past, now understand, I've said in the past, I think we do need to have one giant pool. I think we need to, and I don't care if it's public or private. So I wouldn't be necessarily against the idea of a privatized Medicare for all, as long as there are strict parameters. My problem is I know Republicans are always going to screw those up. So that's where my hesitancy is. But I still think you have to have one pool. Everyone's in. Everyone pays into it. Be much cheaper, much more efficient. We would cut down on a whole bunch of stuff. But it's not going to happen until the profit people, till the money people can see a way to line their pockets. Now, I had a friend years ago. I haven't seen Jerry in a number of years. And I'm not going to say his last name because I don't want to get him in trouble. I don't think I'd get him in trouble. He's retired. He worked for one of the big insurers locally. You know, they've got a color. It's one of the big... you know, it's the red, white, and the other one. This is probably 10, 15 years ago. He said the biggest mistake that they made, you know, the colored place, was not getting involved in Medicare from the beginning. He went into this whole thing about, and this was, I guess this was right around the time, I guess this would have been right around the time of Bush's, disadvantage plan. He said, you know, the insurers should have gotten on board immediately and ensured that government didn't guarantee it. They should have made sure that it was a privatized plan and everyone would get one, and then argue cradle to grave kind of thing so that you would solidify the government paying the policies and ensuring that you had a constant pay model. And you would have the ability to do a bunch of things that progressives and people like me would want. But you could do it at a sizable, tidy profit. And he said that was a great mistake because the insurance industry fought tooth and nail against Medicare because, you know, people who could afford the insurance as seniors were really lucrative. And they would charge rates that were just outrageous. Most seniors couldn't afford it, which is why the government stepped in. So, you know, he was talking about the reality of you know, that policy moving them to where they should have gone back in the 60s. And we are now here. We're now in that position where the privatized insurance companies, I know they're not for profit. Yeah, good luck on that. Where they're now going to take over the market. And because they've sold us. They've conned us. I've seen the ads.
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the Civic ABC Media app. News.